You know, in engineering, there's this constant kind of frustrating trade-off between how strong something is and, well, whether you can actually use it.
Oh, yeah, it's the classic material science dilemma.
We have materials now that are incredibly strong, but actually building with them is a nightmare.
Right. You can make a diamond, but you can't build a bridge out of diamonds. They're too brittle, they're too expensive, and you can't just, weld them together.
Exactly. And that brings us to what we're digging into today. We're looking at a material called superbainite. It's a specific microstructure of steel that is just incredibly fine. We're talking platelets finer than carbon nanotubes, so huge potential for strength and toughness.
There's always a but.
There is always a but, and this one's a big one that stops it from being used in, say, ship hulls or skyscrapers.
And that but is welding.
Welding.
The traditional recipe for superbainite needs a lot of carbon, and high carbon is great for hardness, but it is just awful for welding. If you try to weld it, the heat just makes it crack.
It becomes brittle right there in the heat-affected zone.
Yep. So if you can't weld it, you can't really use it for big infrastructure. You're stuck making small things, gears or bearings.
Okay, so the mission is clear. And that brings us to our source material for today.
Right. It's a PhD thesis by Hongsik Yang from Pohang University. It's titled Design of Low Carbon, Low Temperature Bainite.
So the title basically gives away the whole game. Yang is trying to be an atomic architect. He wants to redesign this super strong steel, but pull the carbon out so it becomes weldable.
All while trying to keep that ultra fine, super strong structure. It sounds simple enough, right? Just take the carbon out.
It sounds simple.
But physically, this is a real high wire act. I mean, to
Sure.
get that superbainite structure, you have to cool the steel to very low temperatures, around 200 Celsius or even lower, and let it transform slowly.
But when you take the carbon out, the steel gets impatient. It doesn't want to wait around.
No, it wants to transform into something else entirely, like right away.
It wants to turn into martensite.
Martensite. And that is the antagonist of this whole story. It's the structure we're desperately trying to avoid.
Because if martensite forms before the bainite gets a chance to grow.
The whole experiment is a failure. You lose the toughness, you lose everything you were going for.
So Yang's entire thesis is basically a fight against time and thermodynamics. He has to cook up an alloy that pushes back against martensite formation long enough for the bainite to form.
Even though he's removed the one thing, carbon, that normally helps you control that process.
So it's a suppression strategy.
That's a perfect way to put it. And to really get how we did it, we have to, get into the weeds of what martensite actually is.
Okay, so let's break it down. We start with austenite. That's the high temperature phase of steel, face-centered cubic structure.
Right. Think of it as a stack of cubes with atoms at the corners and in the center of the faces. It's pretty open.
So atoms can move around.
Exactly. If you cool it slowly, they have time to diffuse. They wander around, find new homes. But martensite is a diffusionless transformation. It happens when you quench the steel, cool it really fast.
Diffusionless. You mean the atoms don't have time to swap places?
No time at all. They don't wander.
Yeah.
Instead, the entire crystal lattice just shears. It snaps into a new shape, mechanically.
From face-centered cubic to a body-centered tetragonal structure.
And the speed of that snap is, well, it's just wild. The thesis mentions the interface moves at up to 1,100 meters per second.
That's faster than the speed of sound.
Way faster,
Yes.
which is why we call it a military transformation. It's not a crowd of people wandering. It's a disciplined, coordinated shift all at once.
Okay, so if they're all moving that fast, what happens to the carbon atoms that were just chilling in the austenite?
They get trapped. They can't get out of the way. And this is so crucial for understanding the properties. In high-carbon steel, those carbon atoms get locked into the new martensite cage. They're forced into these little gaps we call octahedral sites.
Which would create a ton of internal pressure, right?
Massive pressure.
Yeah.
The trapped carbon literally distorts the lattice. It stretches the cube into a rectangle. That's the tetragonality we mentioned.
And all that stress is what makes martensite so hard.
It blocks dislocations from moving, but it's also what makes it so brittle. It's like a spring wound way too tight. It would rather snap than bend.
Okay, so for Yang's experiment, he needs to avoid this sudden snap. He wants the slower, tougher bainite. And to stop the snap, he needs to know exactly when it's going to happen.
Which brings us to the MS temperature, the martensite start temperature.
Right, the MS point. He has to calculate this with extreme precision.
Because if he designs an alloy where the MS is too high, the steel just turns to martensite before it ever gets cool enough to form the good stuff.
And predicting this involves some some really heavy geometry. The thesis goes deep into the phenomenological theory of Morgan-Siddick crystallography.
The PTMC.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is one of the most intellectually demanding theories in all of metallurgy. It is not easy stuff.
Let's try and visualize it, because it is pretty counterintuitive. When austenite transforms, it goes through a shape change called the Bain strain.
Right. Imagine you have a perfect sphere of austenite. The Bain strain basically squashes one axis and expands the others. It turns that sphere into an ellipsoid, like a football.
Okay, but here's the problem I see. If I've got a solid block of metal, and one little grain inside suddenly tries to turn into a football,
it doesn't fit anymore.
It's going to push against everything around it.
Exactly. And if it doesn't fit, the strain energy goes through the roof, and the transformation just won't happen. For the new crystal to grow inside the old one, you need something called an invariant plane.
An invariant plane? So a surface where the geometry doesn't change?
Yes. Think of it like a deck of cards on a table. If you shear the deck, you know, slide the cards over each other.
Right. The deck changes from a rectangle to a parallelogram.
But the bottom card, sliding on the green, felt of the table. That interface, that plane, it hasn't stretched or torn. That's an invariant plane strain.
Okay, I'm with you. We need the atoms to slide over each other so the boundary between the old and new structure matches up perfectly.
But here's the catch. That Bain strain, the football shape, it doesn't naturally give you that invariant plane. It expands and contracts too much.
So what does it do?
The theory says the material has to perform two extra, let's call them gymnastics moves to make it work.
Gymnastics moves.
Okay. First, a rigid body rotation. The crystal actually has to tilt itself to get the planes aligned. And second, something called a lattice invariant deformation. It's an internal shuffling to fix the shape mismatch.
And the shuffling happens in two ways, slipping or twinning.
Correct. Twinning is where the crystal mirrors itself. Slipping is like our deck of cards layers just sliding past each other.
And this is where Yang's low-carbon mission gets tricky, isn't it? High-carbon steels like to twin.
Yes. And low-carbon steels like to slip.
And slipping is messier.
Much messier, crystallographically. It's harder to model, and it changes the whole energy balance of the interface. Because Yang is taking the carbon out, he's forcing the steel into this slip mode, which makes predicting that MS temperature much, much more complex.
Okay, so the geometry is a puzzle, but how does this whole thing even kick off? It has to start somewhere.
Right, this is nucleation. The thesis uses the Olson and Cohen model, and the idea is that the whole transformation starts at a defect, specifically a stacking fault.
A glitch in the matrix.
Essentially, yeah. Imagine you're stacking oranges. They form a perfect pattern. If one layer is slightly off, that's a stacking fault. Olson and Cohen said these faults act as embryos for martensite.
An embryo.
It's a tiny region where the atoms have already shifted into a different structure, a hexagonal one. And that embryo is just sitting there in a constant tug of war.
Okay, who's in this tug of war?
On one side, you have chemical free energy. That's thermodynamics. The atoms want to be in the martensite structure because it's a lower energy state at that temperature. It's pulling them toward transformation.
And on the other side, pulling back.
Strain energy and surface energy. Creating that new boundary and distorting the lattice costs energy, so that resists the change.
So the MS temperature is just the point where the chemical pull finally overpowers the resistance.
It becomes strong enough to just rip that embryo open and trigger the growth. And Yang needs to calculate that exact point so he can design an alloy that keeps the resistance high, pushing that MS temperature down.
He wants to delay the victory for as long as possible.
That's it.
But calculating this for a new alloy, it's not easy. Normally, engineers use, what, empirical equations?
Right. The old way is linear regression. You just say, okay, adding 1% manganese lowers the temperature by 30 degrees, and you just add everything up.
But that assumes the elements don't interact with each other.
Which is a fatal flaw in modern metallurgy.
Yeah.
They absolutely interact in complex, non-linear ways.
Mm-hmm.
The effect of silicon might change completely depending on how much manganese you have. A simple equation can't see that.
So Yang used neural networks instead.
Yes, and this is a perfect use for machine learning. He trained a Bayesian neural network on a huge database of steel experiments. The network isn't looking for a straight line. It's spotting patterns in high-dimensional space. It can see those tricky interactions.
And the thesis says it also gives you an uncertainty value.
Which is so important. A linear equation will give you a number, even if it's a total guess. The neural network says, I predict the MS is 300 degrees, but my error bar is plus or minus 50 degrees because I've never seen an alloy quite like this before.
Which tells the scientist, be careful.
Exactly. It stops you from designing an entire experiment based on a computer's hallucination. He used this to really dial in his alloy, balancing what he calls the frictional work of the elements.
Frictional work?
It's just a term for how much resistance the different elements add to the movement of that interface. You wanted to add elements that act like sand in the gears, you know, slowing down the martensite without ruining everything else.
Okay, so before we get to the results, there was one more piece of this puzzle that I found really counterintuitive. The grain size effect.
Ah, yes. This is fascinating.
Normally in steel, we want small grains, right? The Hall-Petch relationship? Smaller grains, stronger steel?
Right. The instinct is always refine the grains, make them smaller.
But Yang found something totally different for the start of the transformation.
He used something called the Fischer model to look at nucleation. And remember we said nucleation starts at defects. Well, grain boundaries, the edges where crystals meet, are just massive defects. They are prime real estate for nucleation.
So if you have smaller grains,
you have way more grain boundary area, way more walls.
Which means you have way more places for martensite to start.
Exactly. If you make the grains too small, you actually accelerate the martensite transformation right at the beginning. You make your own job harder.
Wow. So that's a really tricky balance. You want small grains for the final strength, but you need bigger grains to stop the transformation from starting too early.
It's a paradox he had to manage. Now, as the transformation gets going, the grain size starts to matter less because of something called autocatalysis.
It feeds on itself.
Right. Once the first plate of martensite forms, it strains the metal around it, which triggers the next plate, and it just becomes a chain reaction.
Okay, so Yang has modeled the geometry, he's used neural networks for the chemistry, he's accounted for grain size and nucleation energy. He makes three alloys, A, B, and C. So what was the verdict? Did we get low-carbon superbainite?
The result was mixed,
okay.
And I think mixed is probably the most honest description for most real research.
Let's start with the good news.
They absolutely succeeded in the suppression part. The neural network predictions were pretty much spot on. He got the MS and the bainite start temperatures down into the ranges he wanted. He also avoided coalesced bainite, which is this coarse, weak structure you don't want.
So the atomic architect built the structure he set out to build.
For the most part, yes. But the mechanical properties, the actual strength and toughness of the steel, were described in the thesis as ordinary.
Ordinary. That has to be a tough word to write after 200 pages of this. Why wasn't it super strong?
It all comes back to the carbon. In the original high-carbon superbainite, you end up with some leftover austenite. Retained austenite.
Okay.
Because there's so much carbon, that leftover stuff is really stable, it's tough, and it actually helps stop cracks from growing.
But Yang took the carbon out to make it weldable.
Right. And without that extra carbon, the retained austenite in his new alloys just wasn't stable enough. When you put it under stress, too much of it just transformed into regular martensite, and you lost that special toughening effect.
So it's a catch-22. You take the carbon out to fix the welding problem, but in doing so, you take out the very thing that made the material super in the first place.
To an extent, yeah. The hardness he got was around 400 vickers, which is, you know, that's respectable, strong steel.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not the 600 or 700 you see in the super versions.
So does that mean the whole thesis was a failure?
No, absolutely not. And this is a really important distinction, I think. Engineering isn't just about making the widget work on day one. It's about building the map.
The map of the atomic lattice.
Exactly. Yang verified that the neural network approach works way better than the old formulas. He refined the PTMC theory to better understand how these low-carbon steels slip. He quantified the grain size effect on nucleation.
So the next person who tries this doesn't have to start from zero.
Not at all. They could look at Yang's work and say, okay, we know we can suppress the temperature. The problem is stabilizing the austenite. So how do we do that without carbon? Maybe we use more nickel. Maybe we try a different heat treatment.
He moved the starting line forward for everyone else.
He did. He proved that the computational tools, this idea of virtual metallurgy, are accurate enough to predict these incredibly complex supersonic transformations. That is a massive win, even if the one specific bar of metal he made wasn't a miracle material.
It's a move away from trial and error and toward design by calculation.
We are getting closer to a world where we can simulate the atomic dance before we even turn on the furnace.
Yeah.
And Yang's work is a foundational block in that wall.
It really makes you look at the steel beams in a building differently. It's not just a chunk of metal. It's a frozen moment in a war between chemical energy and strain energy.
And we're getting better at refereeing that war every single day.
A fascinating look into the microscopic battleground of metallurgy. Thanks for unpacking this.
My pleasure.
And that's it for this deep dive. We'll catch you on the next one.